why these prophets were doomed to utter destruction. We will continue discussing the next verse in the episode to come. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss a deep sense of insecurity growing across Kashmir, and Bangladesh's two options, India or China.
Insecurity is growing in Kashmir, and the local media these days is full of reports of killings of civilians, suspected terrorists, and security forces. Usually, after such incidents, there are massive operations in which up to hundreds of people are arrested and imprisoned, with some of them found dead in jails or on the streets or even in the jungles. However, tightening up security across Kashmir has not been helpful. There are attacks even in Srinagar's crowded markets. Now, let's take a closer look at some of the recent incidents.
There's hundreds of Kashmiris at the farewell for 20-year-old Rafia Nazir. It was a great sorrow for the family to lose the sharp, sensitive and bright girl. She was determined to become a doctor and pull her family out of poverty, but her life and family's hope were cut short. Rafia became a victim of a grenade blast in Amira Kadal as she and her mother were passing the crowded marketplace in central Srinagar in early March. Rafia, who suffered a serious brain injury, succumbed to her wounds the day after. Amira Kadal's attack took the lives of Rafia and an elderly man and wounded 33 others. Kashmir was once regarded the world's most dangerous place. Despite heightened security measures, civilians are subjected to various kinds of offences, not only by suspected militants, but also Indian forces. In one occasion, they arrested more than 1,000 people on suspicion of connection with what they later termed unauthorized groups last October. There are also reports that the security forces used defenseless civilians as human shields during search operations or even violent encounters with protesters or suspected terrorists. This is similar to people's everyday life being caught in the middle.
Large gatherings or Indian armed forces are targeted, but such attacks are not rare in Indian-administered Kashmir. Local officials often criticize Indian forces for their failure to protect civilian lives. They say, at the end of the day, this is the defenseless people who pay the price of insecurity. Of Indian forces' heavy security restrictions, people experience the heavy restrictions to the bones, but not the security. So are these just fresh attempts to disrupt the social harmony in Kashmir?
Kashmir has been divided between India and Pakistan since their partition in 1947. Both Islamabad and New Delhi claim Kashmir in full, and they fought over Kashmir three times. The Indian side of the region has been the scene of constant clashes between security forces and freedom fighters seeking Kashmir's independence or its merger with Pakistan. This has ravaged Kashmir for decades. New Delhi is increasingly using its anti-terror law since the Hindu Nationalist Party, BJP, came to power in 2014. The government of Narendra Modi amended the anti-terror law in 2019. It enabled the authorities to accuse individuals and organizations of terrorism. Thousands of Kashmiris have been imprisoned since the law was passed. Moreover, New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in 2019, turning the bad situation to worse. Later, New Delhi amended the land laws, permitting any Indian to buy land in Indian-administered Kashmir. This made Kashmiris skeptical of New Delhi's intentions of settling outsiders and changing the demographic of the Muslim-majority region. With the BJP's coalition retaining power in the recent assembly elections, Muslims who have already suffered citizenship laws and hijab ban under the ruling party's cultural nationalism policy are now worried more about their security.
Now, to have more insight on the growing insecurity in Kashmir, we are joined by Ahmed Bilghasim, a Kashmiri writer and journalist. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Bilghasim. Now, how do you view using civilian Kashmiris by Indian security forces as human shields in terms of human rights?
So the first thing that we have to understand when we speak about the use of human shields by the Indian state in Kashmir is that for the Indian state, Kashmiris, especially Kashmiri Muslims, are inherently and innately killable. Their bodies are dispensable, their lives have no value, and human shields is just one way of Indian state violating international law and international humanitarian law. And it also goes on to show us that the Indian state really does not care about how it is perceived by the international community. It violates international laws because it knows that there is going to be no concrete accountability about what it does in Kashmir. So there are instances of use of human shields by the Indian state, but it happens on a scale that is way more frequent than people usually think. So for example, in many cases, every single time the Indian state tries to engage in an armed encounter of Kashmiri freedom fighters who are trapped in a house, usually what they do is that they take a Kashmiri, at times even the family members of the people who are trapped inside the house, and then they place the gun on their shoulders, and then they start walking towards the house so that the other party is not able to fire at the Indian occupational forces, because you place their own family members in front of them and they're not going to fire, knowing that it might well go on to kill someone from their own family. So this is how the Indian state has operated in Kashmir, not just after the BJP came into power, but we have instances of human shields used before the rise of BJP into power. It has been happening ever since the 1990s.
Mr. Bilghasim, how do you believe the insecurity in Kashmir mounted after region's special status was revoked by New Delhi?
So I would not actually agree with that assessment, because the problem in Kashmir, many a times people argue that what we see in Kashmir is a condition of lawlessness, and therefore for them, lawlessness stands as a kind of anomaly to a normal and steady rule of law. The thing is that the people of Kashmir are not fighting for regime change. They're not fighting for a different political party coming into power. It's very important for us to remember that what they're fighting for is complete self-determination. What they're fighting for is complete freedom. So if you see how Kashmir was before 2014, before the BJP came into power, you will notice that even at the time of Indian National Congress, even when there was a secular nationalist party ruling Kashmir, the scale of human rights violations was not low at all. So you had arbitrary detentions, you had massacres, you had the use of rape as a weapon of war. All of these things have been happening in Kashmir since 1947. Now, when you ask about the question of the revocation of Article 370, the only reason why the people of Kashmir are anxious about it, because they feel that this revocation transforms the military occupation of Kashmir into an instance of into a structure of settler colonization. So they believe that as the Indian state has revoked Article 370 and now it has allowed non-Kashmiris to settle in Kashmir, they believe that this marks a transformative point in the history of Kashmir, where the Indian state seeks to change the demography of Kashmir and render the Kashmiri Muslims into a minority in their own homeland. So that is the only reason why Kashmiris feel very deeply anxious about the revocation of Article 370.
So how do you think the Muslim majority Kashmir would react to the election result?
So for the Muslims of Kashmir, you see, the idea is that after the BJP came into power, what you see happening with the Muslims in mainland India right now, first of all, starting with the CAA NRC problem, and now the entire controversy around hijab, and now it's wearing hijab has been banned in schools. Many people, they're very surprised by these moves because of the fact that Kashmir has, for the most part, been invisibilized from the conversation. So everything that you see happening in India at the moment against the Muslims in India has been happening against the Muslims of Kashmir for a long, long time. So, for example, the major mosque in Kashmir, referred to as the Jamia Mosque, has been shut down for months on. You have religious educational institutes that have been shut down. You have religious scholars who have been jailed. You have a blatant Islamophobia that constitutes India's juridical and legal framework in Kashmir. So when Kashmiris see the BJP winning elections and retaining power, naturally it signals that things are only going to get worse for them. Though I should add here that even if the BJP were to lose the elections and you had some other party coming into power, maybe it would have changed things for people living in India. But for the people of Kashmir, it would not have changed a lot. With the BJP, the thing is that they have this explicit, outward, visible agenda of Hindu supremacy, and they're working in Kashmir towards institutionalizing it, forcing Kashmiri Muslims to chant slogans of Hinduism, forcing them to recite hymns of Hinduism. So that cultural imperialist project is already going on.
Mr. Bin Qasim, do you believe the hardline Hindus' boosting of power could mount to more insecurity in Kashmir?
Yes, absolutely. With the Hindu nationalist government, the BJP retaining power, there's going to be a greater insecurity in Kashmir because they have a very clear agenda. They have this very clear goal, not since 2014, but if you go through and you read the works of their intellectual forefathers, even in the 1930s and 40s, they had declared that the solution to the Kashmir problem in 1940s, they had declared, lies in the fact that Kashmiri Muslims, who constitute the majority in Kashmir at the moment, have to be rendered into a minority by settling Hindus in Kashmir. They know so long as Kashmiris constitute the majority in Kashmir, Kashmiri Muslims, naturally the movement for self-determination cannot be crushed. People's political consciousness cannot be crushed through economic incentives, through oppression, through different modalities of power. So what the Indian state is going to do as the BJP retains power is that, first of all, they are going to settle the ex-army men in Kashmir. They are going to settle their children in Kashmir. They are going to settle laborers in Kashmir. They are going to take away the resources of Kashmiris and bring in Indian investors, give them lands of the Kashmiri people, force the Kashmiri people to vacate their lands. So naturally, with the BJP retaining power, another 5 years of extreme oppression and repression are lying ahead for the Kashmiris.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Bin Qasim for being on the program. Now let's go to social media, where insecurity in Kashmir is a hot topic, with the reports receiving huge attention.
Umar Ishaq Bhatt blasts the BBC for branding people as terrorists in Kashmir, but calling those fighting Russia freedom fighters. Qamar Mehdi accuses India of state terrorism to suppress people of Kashmir and control their disputed land. Ashok Pandit is the pro-BJP president of the Indian Film and Television Directors Association. He's shared images of the funeral of Rafia Nazir and said her innocence and mourners' wails and cries will always be remembered.
Listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Bangladesh became independent in 1971. It was largely devoid of natural resources and born extremely poor, with the average income of $90 per person. It, however, has earned kudos worldwide as an economic success story in recent years. Each Bengali is now making more than $2,000 a year on average. Along with its economy, Bangladesh is also boosting its military power. It purchases most of its military needs from China, making Bangladesh independent from its larger and more resourceful neighbors.
China is setting up an overhaul facility for FM-90 surface-to-air missile systems in Bangladesh. The missile system was supplied by China over a decade ago. Vanguard is the Chinese company selected as the partner of this maintenance hub. FM-90 is a truck-mounted air defense system. It is an improved version of the Hongqi China produced first in 1998. FM-90 is an anti-aircraft system capable of operations against all types of flying objects, such as planes, missiles, or drones. Its radar system can lock onto the objects within 25 kilometers. The missiles are fired when the objects are at the distance of 16 kilometers. FM-90 is able to operate against multiple targets. It can simultaneously launch missiles to hit multiple objects, including ultra-low-altitude cruise missiles, air-to-surface missiles, and anti-radiation missiles. The maintenance facility deal is set to double up the production assembly lines of the missile and its variants. Even though the deal on the maintenance hub has been announced neither by China nor Bangladesh, the media report the two countries have finalized the agreement. Russia's special operation in Ukraine and the security balance in the Asia-Pacific region have complicated the announcement of the deal.
Bangladesh is surrounded on three sides by India, while the fourth side is the Bay of Bengal. But from New Delhi's point of view, Bangladesh is almost choking India, connecting to its remote northeastern land. This, together with buying Chinese arms, Bangladesh is seen to become a game changer of the region. The Beijing-Dhaka military partnership has not posed any existential threats to India, but India is fiercely pushing Bangladesh to limit its trade with China. So, the question remains, what is making India so horrified?
China supplies most of Bangladesh's military needs, which were worth some $1.2 billion from 2016 to 2020. The maintenance facility of the FM-90 is a part of a defense cooperation treaty signed by China and Bangladesh in 2002. The military treaty also includes warships, naval guns, anti-ship missiles, and military personnel training. In 2016, Bangladesh boosted its naval power by obtaining two submarines from China at the cost of $203 million. In addition to military cooperation, the traditional ally of India has also strengthened its economic relations with China. Bangladesh joined China's Belt and Road Initiative in 2016, and China granted it virtually tariff-free access to its markets. Dhaka's look at Beijing has worried India, which views Bangladesh as its backyard. Especially, India has expressed concern over the recent FM90 facility agreement. In spite of the fact that New Delhi is strengthening its own outreach to Dhaka by providing a credit line for Indian arms, Bangladesh has refused to join the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, which is an informal anti-China military pact comprising India, Japan, Australia, and the US. It seems Bangladesh, which considers itself a close ally of India, likes to maintain its close commercial and military ties with China.
And now Professor Sanjay K. Bharadwaj, the chairperson of Center for South Asian Studies at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, is now joining us to shed more light on Dhaka's look at Beijing. Now, first of all, welcome to the program, Professor. Now, let's begin with your view on Bangladesh's strategy of the growing military partnership with China.
No, Bangladesh has quite fair relations with China on the defense cooperation. You can see since 1975, when the military regime was there in Bangladesh, they had developed close defense partnership, particularly in 1980s, while they opened a small arms factory in Jaipur in Dhaka, near Dhaka. Now, in 2002, I would say that while Khalida Zia was in power, China and Bangladesh, they have signed a defense umbrella cooperation where the maintenance and production of the defense arms that Bangladesh will cooperate with China. In 2011 also, that the Chinese, they have given a missile. So they are in good term for, you can say, in the last 4 decades.
Professor, do you think India is right to be worried about China's missile maintenance deal in Bangladesh?
I don't think that, the first thing, there is a news from Nikki report, but it is not certified because Bangladesh foreign minister declined that there were any deal related to the maintenance of missile. And I'm sure that Bangladesh is well aware about the consequences of having any kind of military or missile maintenance deal with China, because Bangladesh is and India has same or a similar strategic interest in the region, and whatever the development, defense developments and any kind of cooperations take place with Bangladesh, it has a spillover impact on India's security, as well as if India do something with in case of in this region, it has the same implications for Bangladesh. So my point is there that Bangladesh is geostrategically very important for India, and I'm sure that Bangladesh would not go for any kind of or take any kind of initiative that would adversely impact on India's strategic interest. And if there would be any deal between China and Bangladesh, I'm sure Bangladesh government would definitely have consultation with India. So Chinese, they are definitely looking these countries as a market for their arms and technology. But how much it would be worth for Bangladesh to have defense or missile maintenance agreement with China, I don't think it would be worth to go for this deal.
Obviously, China and Bangladesh are sovereign states. Can any third country object to the military partnership between the two countries?
No, I'm sure they are sovereign states, of course, but in the sovereignty also, while the geographically, you know, Bangladesh and India is a proximate country. And while you will see that we are part of common ecological organic system, and if there are any problems, any security issues arise with vis-a-vis Bangladesh, would have adverse impact on India. And if anything, as I said earlier also, So the sovereignty question definitely that is larger than the regional the regional security question is larger than the national security. And if Bangladesh is inviting and bringing any extra regional power that has adverse impact on the regional security, would definitely the end country would not like it. If the, like in case of Sri Lanka also, they were the Chinese were developing Habantota port, but if it has deeper strategic and security implications for India, India was concerned about the same thing. So my point is there, the regional security issues are more important than the national security, particularly keeping India and South Asian countries proximity.
There you go, Professor Bharadwaj from Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. Thank you, Professor, for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see what the users on social media think about the Beijing-Dhaka relations.
Murshid is a Dhaka-based user who shares images of Chinese warplanes purchased by Bangladesh. Anu Anwar is a Harvard University scholar who says China's making a missile overhaul facility in Bangladesh is not a threat to India.
And that was our episode covering tensions in Kashmir and Bangladesh's look at China. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Viewpoints. Joining us in the studio today is a dear friend, Sheikh Mohammed Khani from the Islamic Seminary of Qum and Dr. Ali Alawiyan. Dear brothers, I welcome you both and thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure for us.
Our question today is about video games. What should we do to counter this problem?
I want to benefit from the concept of dhikr here and to reach to this answer,
remembrance.
This answer of you. Yeah. And the concept of dhikr or remembrance of God, it is being said in the hadith that you recite some adhkar, for example, la ilaha illallah, or different adhkar that everyone has ever seen in the books of Dawan hadith. This adhkar, actually the philosophy of having this adhkar is that you recite them and slowly, slowly they will affect your heart. So from something from the surface comes inside your internal, parts, like that heart, which is the center of body or the center of
our soul, leaves,
let's say, or center of our soul. So you see, something that comes from surface goes and it affects the inside. Look, when you see that a person who is involved in playing these games, that actually the kind of violence which is usually categorized in five or six categories, like that of, for example, killing and massacres, noise pollution, and I don't know, annoying people, and also people or even animals, breaking I don't know, doors and windows, and also insults. So all these categories, when you are involved in that, for example, for 1, 2, or 3 hours per day, so this is at surface level. Slowly, slowly, when you are, when you get up from the, I don't know, the place that you have been playing or you have been gaming, so you see these effects slowly, slowly show themselves in your personality and your action. So, and to the extent that is, I think, needed, or our kids are interested, I think we can ask them to, not to limit them to that, because al-insan harisun bimamuna. Let them have a part of these games and not that, let's say, serious, right, violent games. But to the extent that they are interested, to let them play it a bit, but not, and limit the time that they are actually going to be with them. Because right, this level of surface that I was talking about and mentioned and listed the different levels will finally affect the personality of the kid and even the elder ones. And sometimes, look, when for 5, 6 hours that we have seen in some people, you're just insulting people. Then out of sudden, when you are here in the street, unwantedly, and subconsciously, you say something which is which was not in your own inside, but you have taken it from here. Moreover, in learning and acquisition of a second language, I have seen this in theories of second language learning and acquisition. I have seen this theory once, that a part of this theory says that if you want to learn a new language, just listen to that language while you're asleep. So when you get up and you wake up,
that's a pseudoscience, because we have people who say that this doesn't work at all.
And it affects, and I myself practice it, and it works. So in reality, when you are aware and when you are up, then if you see that you are making some sentences that you have never heard before, and you have not, they have not been in your.
In continuation of what the doctor he mentioned, I want to point out that a lot of video games that are being made today also has a lot of elements which is harmful for people that consume, like they benefit from these video games.
Such as
you have pornographic material elements.
Oh yeah, of course, sexual content.
Sexual content, you have abusive language, for example. There's a lot of elements within these video games that we have today, even gambling. There's a lot of elements to it where it's even illegal, but in some countries, unfortunately, it's not illegal. Like children, they can sit, they can buy, they can be encouraged to buy different things that on the other side, they don't know what they're paying for. In other words, it turns into some sort of a gamble, or أكل المالبة باطل, as we say in Arabic as well.
Yeah.
So they are having a transaction which is invalid. Like it's not valid, so within the Islamic perspective.
Video games are normalizing some of these things that are impermissible.
Values, exactly. So if we are aware, we have to look at, first and foremost, we have to administrate the time being spent on video games when it comes to our own children. They need to understand the harm of excessive use. That's the first thing. Second, the content of the video games. What is it that they're benefiting from the video games? What kind of elements are they promoting in the video games or through the video games to these children as well? So that's important for us to understand as parents as well. And we have to be aware of that. So, for example, not just neglecting that fact and just buying a video game without finding out what kind of content that my children is going to be exposed for when it comes to these video games. We have to be aware of that, especially as Muslims, where these video games, it's not like some pious person sitting there. They do it on purpose. I read there was an article that was talking about the famous game, which is called Fortnite.
Yeah.
So they even hired psychologists to make this game as addictive as possible.
Interesting,
right? So there's an article, I think it's on Vice News, you can find that. So they hired psychologists to find out how we can make this game as addictive as possible. So, of course, as a parent, you need to be aware of this.
Because just like nicotine and cigarettes.
Exactly, right? So we don't want our children to be addicted, like drug addicts, but just with video games. That's not an addiction which is beneficial for them or good for them either. So we need to be aware as parents of these things. And, of course, I think the best would be prevention, and is better, always better than cure. So if you just administrate the amount of time they're allowed to use behind the screen, I think a lot of these issues would be solved.
So speaking of prevention, do you think, Doctor, that we should censor video games or just outright ban them like some countries?
No, not to the extent to censor them. Of course, some of them are immoral ones, that those should naturally be censored, because every society likes to observe the borders of morality for itself. So that's something else. But there are some recommendations I think that might work. First of all, to research about the games that we are going to provide and buy for our kids, and to see what kind of, let's say, video games are we buying for them. Second, to increase the media literacy of ourselves as parents, so to know what is going on and what is being said about these games that we are buying and providing for our kids. So media literacy is very important in these days. If a person is lack of digital literacy and media literacy, so I think he has lost the game, I think, to some extent. We are actually the victims then, in order to be defending while we are after defending the rights of kids.
Right now that
moreover, to play with our kids, I mean, we as parents need to play with our kids, to have this friendship with our kids, to be playing with them and to create this environment with them, a cozy environment with them, to let them trust on us and to put us as a part of a partner right. for their games, because this way we can understand more what the dangers of that game as well. At least once we need to right. play with them. And one more solution that I mentioned earlier, to go for some other replacements and substitutions, like right. that of, for example,
physical, another hobby,
physical a more beneficial ones, hobby. Physical ones right. rather than virtual ones.
Right. And now that we're speaking about video games, we must also talk about movies and film series or television mm-hmm. in general. Mm-hmm. As Muslims in a Muslim country, now we're talking specifically about Iran, when you turn on the television, you also see a lot of things that are not Islamic, mm-hmm. either be it hijab or some other things. What should we do to help our children understand that this is not correct, when even the state television is mm. broadcasting these things? Mm. Because a question that is often posed, or a counter argument when you try and preach, for example, or convince a person who say that hijab should be so and so, they just point at the television and say, we are in an Islamic country and this is a state broadcast television and they are wearing hijab such and such.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do?
I think the same question was asked from the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Khamenei, once. They asked him, so we in television, we can see some images that, for example, it's difficult for our kids to not persuade them kids, that this is...
everyone, yeah, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So the answer is, brother, while television is bringing some videos, at least in our country, alhamdulillah, is much more restricted and tries to make best use of it, and tries to actually to show whatever, to the extent that they can, to right. show whatever they are able to show to the people, in order to refrain from censorship, to like other countries that they are going right. for. But still, the leader says, even for my kids, for my grandsons, I'm not advising them to see a part of these, for example, shows or, I don't know, series from television.
Some people who do not even look at television.
But, sorry?
Do not even look at, do not even view television at yeah. all. Completely so cut it off out of their lives.
We don't have television now.
Yeah. So you see, when he says that a person, a family, they themselves should decide for themselves that what kind of series and what kind of documentaries and, I don't know, films and videos are right. good for mm-hmm. themselves, and to look, even in the street, brother, look, in the street that we are walking, are we allowed to look at every scene that we see in the street? So we can, here the leader or the marja is not with us to tell us, okay, here you are allowed, here you are not allowed. Then based on the principles that we have as a parent, then our kids are looking at our own behaviors.
Right.
Then when we actually try to correct ourselves first, then they will imitate whatever we are doing. Then, for example, in the street, we tell them every scene is not deserved to be looked at.
Right.
The same goes for the TV. Every, let's say, music, every, let's say, video, every film is not deserved to be, is not worth of being watched by you.
Right. Dear Sheikh, you said that you yourselves do not have a television
no,
at home.
No.
What really? Are the reasons, if I might ask?
Yeah, that's because we were born and raised in families where televisions were a big part of our life. Like
yeah.
when we grew up in the West. So we decided not to have a television, to be honest, and that was to focus more on activities that didn't have anything to do with a screen. Of course, we have a computer, so if we want to see a documentary, for example, we can do that on the laptop. But we decided not to have a television because of the fact that the doctor he mentioned as well. So children, they look at us. So if they seeing their father or their mother spend hours behind a screen, for example, just let the television run in the background while the children are playing around and stuff.
Right.
We can't have the expectation that they're not gonna, what is it called, watch what's being portrayed in the
right.
television. And we don't feel that televisions always can be controlled. Even, unfortunately, here in Iran, there's a lot of things which is being movies that are being put to the media, yeah, they're censoring certain things and filtering certain things, but there's still things that I don't want to expose my children for. So
right.
We just decided not to have a television because when we have a computer, we can decide what to put on and what not to put
true,
on.
True, because also when you censor some aspects of a movie, you are also at the same time allowing other things.
Yeah, of course. If you have a movie, it's not only about what we consider directly to be harmful.
Right.
Also values and ideas.
Yeah.
Right? Sometimes a movie can be based on that success is equal to, for example, having a nice life here in this world, in this worldly
right.
life.
Right. And being rich.
Being rich, for example, sense. Right? Yeah. Just given very obvious example from a lot of movies that we
yeah.
see, for example, from Hollywood. Of course, I don't want my child to grow up thinking that being rich is equal to being successful or attaining happiness and success. So that's our decision.
So yeah. just one final question, dear Sheikh. Would you advise other parents to adapt this lifestyle of yours?
Not necessary. But I would advise anyone who has a television to make sure that the television is only on for a specific amount of time a day. And it's not something which is just being done as a form of entertainment. Yeah.
And on that note, we will have to end today's program because we are unfortunately out of time. Dear Sheikh, I thank you for joining us in today's discussion.
Jazakallah khair.
And also thank the dear doctor for helping us and contributing to this fruitful discussion.
It was a great pleasure.
And finally, I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
Imam إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are focusing on the first sermon, in parts of the first sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains the revolutionary nature of the Holy Quran, that the Qur'an contains these general principles that can always be referred to in the path of change, in the path of growth, and reaching the direction that is required by the Islamic Ummah. That means that the Qur'an needs to be a book that can be understood by all. It's a book that needs to be referable by everyone. Of course, that doesn't mean that it doesn't require a teacher and a guide, because not all the verses are clear, not all the verses have a clear meaning, and sometimes the verses explain other verses, or certain statements of the Imams or the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam explain the verses, and some details have not come. So all of these mean that there is a requirement of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasallam. Yet we need to have that balanced approach. And we've been discussing about this balanced approach for some time, until we reached this discussion where we said that this thought of limiting the Quran just to reading and all that, this is something that was something inherited from very wrong people, very wrong understandings, and therefore we need to avoid this type of thinking.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, there is another argument that we can pose to the people who say that you cannot make use and understand even one verse of the Quran without the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. The argument is like this, that if you look at those books of exegesis or the books of tafsir that have riwayat or the narrations quoted, or we can say they are tafsir riwayi, they are tafsirs that are based on narrations. So a verse is brought, and then certain narrations that are under or related to that verse are brought. If you look at these tafsir, for example, tafsir Nur al-Thaqalain, or tafsir Burhan, or similar other tafsir, we'll notice that only a few verses of the Quran have got narrations explaining them. A majority of the verses of the Quran, at least two-thirds of the verses of the Quran, do not have narration specifically speaking about those verses or explaining those verses. In other words, these people would be saying that, majority of the Quran is useless, is not understandable. It's like when you read it, it's like you have a blank information inside your mind. That would be absolutely wrong to say. It would be against the wisdom of God to be able to create such a system whereby the Quran is there but it's not understood by the people unless and until they have riwayat. And the problem is that riwayat are not there in such high numbers. So it's as if these people are telling us that, you know, you can just just take those verses and you might not understand the meaning. It doesn't matter. Like, you know, you'll remain blank, which is absolutely against God's wisdom and against the logic and intellect. And therefore, definitely this argument means that we are able to understand certain verses, majority of the verses of the Quran, in fact. But yes, the Quran needs certain places needs explanation, certain areas need depth, and all of that comes from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Another argument that can be posed is that if you're saying that the verses of the Quran sometimes cannot be understood, then how sure are you that the narrations are all understood? Because they are both in Arabic. If you are not able to understand, you're saying that the Quran is a book that cannot be understood. So majority of the times, the narrations also cannot be understood because they are in the same language. Sometimes they speak in the same manner. So you are trying to say that the Quran can be understood, cannot be understood, but the narrations can be understood. Under what basis? So we notice that both of these need each other. The narrations need the Quran because the Quran is the basis through which all these narrations have come. The Quran also needs the narrations because these narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi muslim explain those verses at depth, flesh, you know, and you know, different they you know, give perspective to that verse of the Quran. This unfortunately is the result of those enemies of the Quran, enemies of the religion of God, who want to seclude the Quran in a corner and leave and separate Islam from the Quran. This is something that needs to be very, very carefully looked into you know, understood properly. Yes, you know, sometimes what happens is that people tend to, you know, accept things that look simple and, you know, easy to understand, and they feel that, you know, this is something that we can accept quickly. But, you know, life is not always about taking things easy. Sometimes you need to be able to give depth through your thinking and the way you, you know, you decide about how to make use of your religion and how you're able to interact with the religious information that is there around you. And when you use that aspect, you realize that the Quran itself has got all of these verses that are inviting us all towards, you know, pondering. And all these arguments come to your mind, and of course you make a decision regarding what your viewpoint is. Inshallah, we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we are able to understand the Quran properly, and we are able to use the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam to give us depth and strength in understanding the Quran properly. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Economic divide. We'll be right back.
crisis between Russia and Ukraine has wreaked havoc in global oil markets. Russia plays a pivotal role in the global energy supply, and destabilization could send shockwaves to the global economy. It is the third biggest producer of oil in the world, behind the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. It produces around 7 million barrels of oil per day, which is about 7% of global oil supply. Russian imports account for 8% of total U.K. oil demand. More than 40% of what it produces every day goes to Europe. The U.S. is less reliant, with about 3% of its imported oil coming from Russia. Oil prices have reached their highest levels in years. Experts warn sanctions on Russia's energy products could be catastrophic for the global economy. They say the global economy could be facing one of the largest energy supply shocks ever. There are now warnings that prices of oil per barrel could reach $180 to $200.
Here in the United States, I mean, we've imported 200,000 barrels a day. We imported about 450,000 barrels of product, mostly unfinished distillate that we run through the refinery to boost yields on the other end of the refinery. It comes out more distillate, more gasoline. We don't really need those 200 barrels. We don't need those 450,000 barrels. So we can definitely exist without that. It's a spit in the bucket. The Eurozone, we're talking percentage points, double digits. So it's a totally different game.
Russia has already warned that prices could reach $300 per barrel if the West decides to shun its oil and gas from the markets. Supply shortages, bottlenecks, and price pressures caused by the coronavirus pandemic have already disrupted the global economy, and there are fears that further price shocks would have catastrophic consequences.
The whole notion of sanctioning a country is to make the governing body suffer, and not the ordinary citizens. But that may not be the case when it comes to the U.S. in particular, than the Europeans. Let's see what people had to say about that in our social media section of the program. Well, this person has the right idea, even though the U.K. is too entrenched in this already. The U.K. should stay out of the Russia-Ukraine war, apart from that, to de-escalate and then try to bring in or bring the fighting to an end. Do not enact a no-fly zone, do not send weapons, and stop ramping up sanctions against all of Russia. That only hurts ordinary people rather than what he or this person says is the regime there. Next one, what a display of duplicity and hypocrisy of Europe's leaders. How can they expect Russia to supply gas, fuel, while their non-military entities, artists, sportspersons, ordinary people are being hit by sanctions? How will Germany or Hungary pay for energy with no SWIFT links? Next one, we do not support Joe Biden's sanctions on Russia. Sanctions will only hurt ordinary Americans by further hiking up gas prices. Biden's already slashed domestic production, and the Saudis have declined to raise output. Well, this new sanctions package will cripple America, not Russia. And finally, you're hurting Americans at the pump. Your sanctions are going to hurt us more than Russia, and the only ones in Russia that would be hurt are ordinary people there, just like the ones that you're hurting here at home. Open up the pipelines and drop all federal fuel taxes. Okay, some of the social media posts which seem to agree with us in terms of how ordinary people are suffering. Okay, joining us in this segment of the Q&A is Attilio Boron. He's a political scientist and international analyst who joins us from Buenos Aires. Attilio Boron, welcome. We're taking a look at, obviously, what has happened with this conflict of Russia's military operation, which has shocked the oil markets. Looking for replacements has been something that the U.S. is after, but it hasn't been successful. In the meantime, obviously, Europe is wanting to go with the U.S., but finding a replacement for oil and gas is a tough thing. What is your assessment as to whether this can be done to help the ordinary people who are suffering the most here?
Not at all. The world is hungry and thirsty of consuming oil, so there will be no problem for the Russians. Of course, there will be necessary to make some adjustments in all the pipelines which Russia has developed, but there is no question that they could divert the proportion, a high proportion at least, of the oil that they were exporting to Russia to the south.
That's indeed going to be a challenge also. Our next guest, Carlos Martinez, joins us from London. He is an activist and political analyst. Carlos Martinez, welcome to the program. If we were to take a look at an ulterior motive that the U.S. may have on this, it has pointed to it's shale gas. And of course, that involves fracking. But we know the hazards that are involved with that environmentally. At the same time, the inferior quality that consists shale gas. How can that even be used to provide shortages, for example, in the case of urea? Does that even feel